Hello and welcome to this week's TES podcast. I'm reporter Dave Speck and joining me is Deputy News Editor Mary-Louise Clues. Mary-Louise, hello.
Hi there.
We've got reporter John Roberts. Hiya, John.
Hello there.
And reporter Amy Gibbons. Hi, Amy.
Hiya.
Now, it's finally here, the end of term, and we're all limping to the finish line today after what's been described this week as a year of unprecedented disruption. I think that's really putting it mildly, to be honest. And in a minute, we're each going to pick out what we think was the biggest story of the year. And I can tell you there are plenty to choose from. But it seems that one of the biggest stories may have been in the penultimate week of the year, when we had more than a million pupils isolating. Amy, what were the stats on that one?
Big moment, I think. So, a million is quite a round number, isn't it, as well? So it gets people talking about it. But yeah, huge number of pupils off last Thursday. It was 1.05 million. And also kind of the trend has continued where there's a lot off in secondary schools. So 17.9% absence in secondary school. Huge. And that's
almost one in five, isn't it, that?
Yeah. Almost.
Sorry to do the maths.
Well, yeah, not quite, but almost one in five, and then at 13.5% the previous week. So if you just look at the percentage point rise in that week alone, that's massive. So huge amount of kids off this week. In primary schools, it was 12.1% for COVID reasons, compared with 9.8% the last week. Obviously, it's worth noting that the vast majority of these kids are at home because they've been in contact with a case of coronavirus inside school. So of those million children who are at home, 773,000 are isolating because of potential contact, and actually only 47,200 had a confirmed case of COVID, and 34,500 had a suspected case of COVID. So if you put that into some context, this sort of trend is likely why they are moving away from that bubble system.
Indeed.
Which I know John has been covering.
You may be tempted to think that term has ended early, the holidays have started early for those children, but actually there's been a large uptake in Oak Academy lessons, hasn't there, in these final weeks when the absences have been rising. Would that be fair?
That's absolutely right, yeah. So obviously it is approaching the end of term, but isolation, it still means homeschooling. You know, it's not supposed to mean that they just get on with the holidays. And actually, that does appear to be what's happening. So in terms of they are still accessing home lessons. The usage of Oak Academy has been increasing. There are over 300,000 pupils using Oak in the final weeks of term, which is an uptick in their usage. So that is happening. People are using Oak. It's good to see that the resource is still being used. It's got a purpose.
And of course, it gives us a little way into your exclusive interview with the Oak head, Matt Hood,
this week as well.
And he gave us a glimpse into the future of Oak, didn't he? And how it's going to survive in the short term.
Definitely, yeah. There's been loads of talk about what might happen with Oak. Obviously, it was set up as this kind of pandemic school. It was all done very quickly. It had to be. And now there are questions. There's all this brilliant resources out there about how they might be used in future, or if there is a future for Oak itself. So what we found out this week is that Oak is getting an extension in its funding for two more terms. So it will kind of carry on as is, supporting pupils, also teachers at home during COVID. But beyond that, there are conversations going on with the DfE about how Oak might become an arm's length government body, which would mean it'd be publicly funded. But what hasn't been decided is exactly how that might work. Listeners might know that there's a range of different ways that quangos might be structured in the government. They might have more kind of oversight from government departments, or they might have a greater deal more independence. Accountability is a big question there. These are all things I put to Matt, but actually at this stage, they're still very much, you know, considering a whole range of options. So they couldn't completely narrow it down to what it might look like.
I thought what was interesting in that interview, actually, Amy, was when he was talking about, I think when you were speaking to him, you mentioned arms length bodies like Ofsted and Ofqual that within education, but he mentioned looking across government at other types of organisations, publicly funded organisations that might provide a model that they could run along on along the same lines. So sort of leading to speculation, wasn't it, between us and sort of BBC, maybe? Is that a model that they could look at? Is there, I'm just trying to think of some others, NHS? I mean,
there's so many different types out there. And sadly, and understandably, I mean, Matt couldn't really be drawn on kind of naming any in particular. Mm. I think if he were to do that, immediately there'd be loads of questions like, is Oak the new sort of a, you know, BBC structure?
Yeah.
So he didn't, but he did say, I'd named a couple that they were kind of, and I'd named Ofqual that, you know, might be taken into consideration. And those as well, which have nothing to do with education. So they will be looking outside of the DfE as well for kind of structures that they could use. But yeah, very much, they talked about sliding scales in what they might end up doing. So at the moment, we don't have any kind of concrete proposals, but it's really interesting to hear about what might be kind of on the table they might be considering.
Mm. Just going back to the immediate pandemic and the problems it's causing, John, can I ask you about what heads have been up to this week? Because they weren't supposed to be tracing COVID contacts under the new DfE guidance, were they? But it's perhaps no surprise that they were in fact doing just that.
Yeah, absolutely. So as you say, with us reaching step four on Monday, the government had told schools last week, and in announcements before that too, that as of step four, contact tracing, so basically identifying who the contacts of a COVID case are and who needs to isolate, which has been a massive burden on school leaders throughout this crisis, that would end, that you wouldn't be routinely involved in that, and that all of it was going to NHS test and trace. There was a kind of a caveat that if there was a big outbreak at your school, then you'd need to be involved. But what's happened, we had an exclusive earlier this week, and we'll have another today, is that essentially on the ground, lots of local authorities, local public health teams have said, well, we want you to carry on doing this. COVID's still high in our area. So we want you to carry on with your arrangements. You know best who the close contacts are, carry on doing the work. And there's been kind of a mixed reaction to that. So ASCL basically said this should not be happening and the DfE need to tackle it, because we were literally explicitly told that this responsibility was taken off us. Yeah. And there's a question mark, I think, about on what basis schools can do this, because effectively the government have said, no, it's NHS test and trace's responsibility to now say who a contact is. So there is still a question about what legitimacy does a school have to phone a family up and say, your child needs to be off school. Because if they were kind of following this closely, they could say, well, no, that's not your job anymore.
That the parents would say that to the school. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And it's, we found like a real postcode lottery with it happening in some areas and not in others. And that obviously means that the other big difference, I should say, is that in the guidance that the government gave to schools last week, it kind of indicated that they didn't really expect there to be many close contacts in schools, which is really surreal because, as Amy just said, there's, you know, the best part of a million kids currently isolating because they are contacts. And yet the latest guidance has said it's only if you've been in close contact for a prolonged period of time that you're likely to be identified as a contact, e.g. a sleepover, which just seems so surreal compared to what we've known for most of this year, which is essentially people sat near you or your class or even your year group all going home as contacts. So that's the other thing. Essentially, we've had almost like a two-tier system this week, where in some schools and settings and local authority areas, you'll have bubbles going home as has been the case for the rest of the year. Yeah. And then in others, you'll have the school waiting to hear from NHS test and trace. And I think I realised, you know, we're kind of at the end of the road in terms of the academic year, but I am keen to kind of drill down a bit more into that and find out exactly how that worked.
It's got 25 local authority areas, wasn't it?
That we found, yeah, of the ones we know, certainly around half of the ones we've had definitive responses from ask schools to carry on. One said, well, it's like we've got 4 days left. It would be ridiculous to introduce a new system now. Waltham Forest in London. So it's a chaotic picture, chaotic end to a chaotic year, I guess, where the two different systems in place and not a great deal of certainty about who has the actual responsibility, because effectively you've got government guidance saying one thing, local public health staff saying another, and schools in the middle trying to decide what to do.
I was going to say, John, what, could you sum it up in one word? But you probably better not, actually. just let me keep you on for now, because I know there's been strong words from the teachers' peer review body this week about the plan to freeze teacher pay next year. Just briefly, John, talk us through that, would you?
So this is something that's been in train for a while. We knew at the end of last year that it was recommended that there wouldn't be a pay rise for most teachers. And the STRB's report came out this week with basically saying the Education Secretary didn't ask us to look for any recommendations on pay rise for teachers above a sort of a 24,000. So the vast majority of the profession are not getting a pay rise this year because we haven't been asked to look at it. Gavin Williamson said in a written statement that he's accepted that recommendation. Now, there's been two new bits, if you like. Union anger, which we would well expect, saying that it's an absolute insult, both the fact that there's not been a pay rise after the kind of incredible year, but also the timing of it, literally end of the day in the last week of term. For some schools, beyond the last week of term, they'll have already broken up.
It's always the case, isn't it? They always put this out in the last week of term. It seems for that very reason that there's just teachers haven't got any fight left in them at this point in the year.
Happy holidays.
And I think the line absolute insult, it struck me. But the other thing that's really interesting, I think, is the STRB report itself basically recommends the government don't do this again, and that a continuation of a pay freeze could affect the standing of the profession and affect efforts to retain and attract new staff.
What the Institute for Fiscal Studies has said, John. Sorry to interrupt you, but mentioning this story I did this morning, that the IFS, this research body, has said that done some analysis, and it's found that in real terms, teacher pay has dropped 8% since 2007. I'm talking about pay for experienced teachers. And what seems really infuriating is that compared to average earnings across all professions, which have now recovered to just above the level seen in 2007.
Yeah, well, one thing that struck me was we had this kind of line earlier in the year suggesting that because, maybe even going back into the previous academic year, basically saying because COVID is going to deliver such an economic crisis, the teacher recruitment will be less of a challenge because effectively it has stability when so many sectors, private sectors, third sectors might not. And so I don't know whether that's impacted the government's thinking, basically, that we don't need to give a pay rise. But it strikes me that there's, what's the kind of an unknown is how much damage to goodwill has the government done with this, coupled with everything else, and how many teachers will think, or head teachers will think, once they feel like they've got beyond this crisis, which might still be quite a way down the road, I'm done. Do you know what I mean? That essentially.
Well, if you look at research by the NHT, I think it's something like 47% of school leaders have said they want to leave early, leave the profession early, as a result or since the pandemic started. It's something astonishing like that, as you probably remember. Shall we move on to our finale of this podcast and the finale of the, you know, this year, which Jeff Barton, the head of ASCIL, has this week described as a year of unprecedented educational disruption, which, you know, again, he's putting it mildly. But let me ask you, what stories stand out for you? And I know this is a tough decision to just pick one, but Amy, what a year we've had, haven't we, as reporters during this pandemic? It just goes from one unbelievable, astonishing thing to report on to another, whether it's...
Absolutely, yeah.
Go on, what did you pick?
It's been an extraordinary year, hasn't it? And slightly sport for choice in terms of the biggest stories. I think the story that stands out to me at the most, it is right at the beginning of the academic year, but it really set the tone, I think, for what was to come with various kind of changes in guidance and U-turns and all that sort of thing. I mean, listeners will remember that back over the summer last year, schools were advised to plan for a new contingency framework for COVID, which was separate from the national framework. It had these four tiers versus, I think at the time, the national one was three tiers. That's also changed quite a lot. It wasn't completely clear how both of those systems interacted with each other. And what we kind of... We revealed later, you know, at the beginning of the autumn term, was how no schools had moved past tier one of this education tier framework. It really was remaining quite unused. And the government had decided it would actually be revising the framework to take out certain bits. So the most important part in all of this was that schools had been asked to plan for rota systems, which they would have needed to implement if any of them had moved, you know, through this tiered framework that they'd been asked to plan for. And the DfE decided in the new academic year that it didn't actually like the idea of rotas at all, didn't want schools to use them, and went as far as banning them, completely removing them from the framework, and then just moving on. So schools kind of had to come up with all of these plans, tear them up, and then learn an entirely new contingency framework after that. And it was just extraordinary how they'd been asked to do all of that planning, and then actually were being told, if you go ahead and use any of those plans that we asked you to make, you're going to be in a lot of trouble. I just thought it was
I remember that. John, what would your one story be?
I guess I'd follow on from that. I think the big theme of this year has been that the government has wanted to keep schools open even when everything else is closed. So essentially the kind of the focus has been sort of saying education is a priority. What that's meant is we need to keep schools open come what may. And so, as Amy said, they kind of reassured schools at the start of the year that you could use rotas, but then never allowed anyone to get there. And that kind of escalated throughout the year as COVID was going up and up and up and up. You got councils and multi-academy trusts saying, we're going to move to rotas ourselves in December. And you have the surreal thing of the government actually threatening legal action. And in one case, literally kind of starting that process in a letter to a council in London, you know, using emergency COVID legislation to stop schools combating COVID. I thought that was totally surreal.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had that going into Christmas. Then we had like the Christmas mixing. And then if you remember, Boris Johnson appeared on the TV on the Sunday to say schools are safe, send your kids back in. And then the very next day, actually, mm-hmm. COVID's too high, we're going to do a complete national lockdown. I just think that kind of chaos from the last
the next day, they opened, first week of
January.
They did open for that one
day. So they were open one day.
Was that because of what Boris had said? Exactly. Was that because of what the Prime Minister said in that interview? That he couldn't look stupid, could he? So they had to open schools.
Well, they delayed the lockdown by a single day. So a national lockdown seemed inevitable. Schools were due to come back. And instead of announcing it on the Sunday night, they announced it on the Monday night. So we had the surreal thing where, I mean, it wasn't all schools, because as we'd done an exclusive on, they kind of staggered the start of term to allow for testing that they'd planned to do. So it was only some year groups, mainly primary, that were in. But it's just surreal.
Mary Louise, can I turn to you and ask you, what was your biggest story this year that you've worked on?
Well, it obviously, as others have said, it's difficult to choose in quite a dramatic year, but I'd echo the ones that others have picked, but also on top, that probably in the same category, is the announcement about exams, which was on the same day as obviously the national lockdown was and schools closing was announced, that in early January. Prime Minister also said that exams would be cancelled. And this was after a whole autumn term of talking about how exams were going to be run and teachers preparing and school leaders preparing for optionality and various different things, different ways of running exams. And then in January, you had this announcement that actually they were, in fact, not going to go ahead. And I think there'd been various calls for this to happen before. This is really a sort of typical story of how education policy has been handled in the pandemic. First of all, you have late notice for teachers and kind of to prepare. And then you have confusing and muddled guidance that doesn't really make any sense. So, for example, there was lots of talk about how obviously the Prime Minister and subsequent announcements from the DfE were saying that, that teachers would assess grades and there would be no algorithm this year. But then there was, it seemed to be confusing messages about how that, how those teacher assessed grades would be supported, what evidence would be needed to support those grades. So there was a really strong message out of government saying we won't be having mini exams, there won't be sort of exams by the back door. But then we had guidance from the JCQ, which the Joint Council Qualifications, that was, seemed to be very contradictory, that said teachers have, on the one hand, it said teachers have the flexibility to choose from a range of evidence, but on the other hand said, well, there is no type of evidence that takes precedence. Evidence gathered in conditions that enable confidence about the authenticity of the student's work will be given more, will give more confidence in the overall holistic judgment. So basically, you know, assessments, teachers, school leaders, colleges interpreted that as we need to do sort of exam condition assessments or do some, or do tests in classrooms in order to have data that we can, that the JCQ, which the authorities are going to be confident of and that we can stand behind. So you did have a situation where on the one hand, government was saying we're not going to be running exams or mini exams, or we don't want mock exams to be going on, but actually then students going through much earlier than they would have expected, a whole series of tests. So they had that, so that confused confusion. Then we had a row about cash, about money, head teachers saying, we're doing all the work, can we have a rebate please from the exam boards? Exam boards saying, well, no, we're still doing a lot of stuff, and you know, rows about that.
And then subsequently, they've offered, I think one of the big exam boards offered 26% last week, wasn't it?
Yes.
Which seems woefully low, considering all that.
That's not gone down too well with head teachers, as we said, put it mildly. And then we've got, now we're kind of in the press, in the situation where all the evidence has been submitted, the grades are being checked. I think Gibb was in House of Commons, Schools Minister Nick Gibb was in the House of Commons talking about it this week, saying that the vast majority of the evidence had been submitted and quality assurance processes was underway, although he did say that final checks were still happening, which we reported on this week. But now we're in a situation where from parents to teachers, they're all saying, we think this process has been unfair. We think the grading is going to be unfair. There's concerns about the widening gap between disadvantaged students and other students. So all in all, we're set up for quite a results week in 3 weeks' time. So strap in, I'd say.
And more work to come for teachers on the appeals, for teachers and heads on the appeals. Well, look, let's wrap up there. It's been an incredibly difficult year, and you know, hopefully we've pulled out some of the most important bits there. Have a great summer holidays, everyone, and keep listening. See you soon. Bye.
Bye.